Dr. Murphy, with the recent development of self-driving cars, the age-old trolley problem is once again being widely discussed. Quite recently, researchers posed this question to Sophia, the humanoid robot. Sophia, when presented with this problem, allowed 5 people to be killed. Could you reason why Sophia chose to do so?
I hate the trolley problem. It's sort of like, will that just die? Okay, so there's first off, the trolley problem is an old problem that is for philosophy majors. So you put it out there. It's not a very practical problem. It's just to see, well, really, how do you value human life? What's that? Oh, why did you do any cultural assumptions? Do you have any inherent biases? Oh, look, not everybody in the room answers the same way you did. Does that mean they're evil? No, probably not. You know, oh, look, life is more complicated. Who knew? Okay, great. So that was the purpose of the trolley problem. It was never, oh, I think Gary Marcus, who normally I love, but this is just like, no, Gary, stop, stop, stop. First off, robots, how would you know there are 5 people versus this? You know, if I threw something at you, do you know, and it looks like something like a rock, do you know it's a rock or it's really a Nerf ball rock that's soft? You duck, you flinch because you're in a reflexive loop because that's the only way you can go fast enough. If you have to go beyond and up here and through here and back down, you can't do it fast enough. The numbers, the control theory, you can't do it fast. It's the same thing with robots. If I want to stop and not hit anybody, I'm not going, oh, I am stopping for the attractive little child and her loving family. Oh, I am stopping for the Nobel Prize winner. What? What? How would you know? Why would the car know that you are more valuable to society because you're a famous scientist than a homeless person? That's creepy. Why would we give privacy? No, it's like something in the way, crap, 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 stop, 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 versus are 2 things in the way. Which way can I causes me less likely to flip over and kill the people in my car? Because I turn too hard and flip over. I mean, that's what control theory, AI, and things are actually doing. They're not, oh, you know, there's a child, but they look healthy. That person, they've got cancer, they're gonna die in a year, so we'll just hit them. No, that only shows up in the movie I, Robot, right? You know, no, 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 no.
Yeah, that's true. So, do you think emotions can be simulated through AI in the years to come?
Yes, and we think that emotions will be in part of any AI system. In fact, almost any intelligent robot, they kind of are now. So emotions are actually not something that get added on later on. I mean, you know, people are approaching it that way, but since the 1980s, lots of lovely work have been done in emotional, what we would call emotional control. So things aren't working, you try harder, and then you just change, right? Well, that's kind of what we call frustration and anger. We have emotions, they're very basic. You can see animals have that. They have these emotional responses. They may not be doing love sonnets, although we think maybe whales and maybe birds are doing that. But you know, it's a form of regulation. Lots of things are going on. It's not working. I'm getting more frustrated. I'm going to try things, and now I'm going to shift radically because too much is going on. You only have so much reasoning capacity, and particularly in real time. So we think that those types of emotions, and interesting, negative emotions are the most useful to an agent because if you're happy, that means nothing needs to change. Happy, 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 just all, oh, just it's when, you know, so the grumpy, something's wrong, or it's not working. And we certainly need that to help regulate and get a good response.
So, okay. Dr. Murphy, could I have your opinion on something? Like, I read in some book, like on a robot. The author is it's not actually a book on science or something, a story book in which, yeah, I think it was one of Dan Brown something, Origins. So there it's mentioned that one of the major advantages of being a robot or AI something is that it can approach a task like maybe 1,000 times without feeling any frustration, unlike humans. It can approach it every time with the same efficiency. So taking that into account, do you think it is a good thing or bad thing that we can maybe simulate emotions?
Okay, so we're talking Dan Brown here. So let's, you know, Da Vinci Code. So let's say, so what it sounds like he described was automation.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a difference between robots for automation, where the objective is to have them do the same task repetitively, very accurately, as fast as inhumanly possible, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So that 1,000 times a day. Now we're talking about, on this other side, AI robots that have to deal with the open world. So that world in a factory for automation, you assume you know everything. You even know the temperature of the air. You know how hot it gets. You're factoring all of that in. It's totally controlled. The task, extraordinarily well known. Once you start going out in the open world, who knows what's going to happen? You know, imagine doing a delivery robot going down a sidewalk. Who knows? I mean, you could have a bird drop in front. You could have people kick it. You could have this. You could have an elephant walk by. I mean, how would you even model that? Okay, all of those things. So now you have to go to a different model where things like frustration. Okay, I keep trying this. I need to stop. Like a fly at a wall. I mean, we would like you to be smarter, our robots to be smarter than a fly, right? It'll just go bang against the window. Bam. Okay. I want to go to the bright. Wake up. I want to go to the brightest light. Bam. I want to go to the brightest light. Well, the fly never gets frustrated, right? It's not smart enough to know that it's just doing the same thing over and over and not getting toward that bright light. And so that's what we would like to see in robots. So we're going to see in these robots that work in the open world, the really intelligent ones. Not that the laboratory automation, factory automation is not sophisticated intelligent, but it's a different intelligence. It's an open world intelligence.
Yeah, I got it now.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, Dr. Murphy, not many people have a law named after them. Could you tell our audience what Murphy's Law is all about?
Well, there's the famous Murphy's Law that came through the 40s about if anything can go wrong, it will. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, and that's kind of been our family motto. But I actually had a cognitive scientist named Dr. David Woods at Ohio State created Robin Murphy's Law of Automation. And it is our autonomy, the Murphy's Law of Autonomy. And that is, whatever level of autonomy or amount of autonomy that you think your robot's going to have, it's going to be way less when you get it into the field. You won't be able to make it work that way. It's going to be significantly dumber because you can't predict everything that goes around it. And trying to, particularly in the laboratory to the real world, is a huge shift.
So many variables.
Yeah. So anyway, I have a law named after me.
Now, we are going through this pandemic. So how do you think, how are robots being used to help alleviate this? Also, do you think the use of humanoid robots to assist doctors is an efficient healthcare solution in this scenario?
Well, we've been documenting what robots are being used for. And we're seeing about 30 major use cases. They span things, surprising, not all aspects, not just healthcare, not just clinical care in hospitals. We're seeing public safety for disinfecting large spaces, for quarantine enforcement, that sort of thing. We're seeing maintaining work and education. We're seeing quality of life, delivery, getting food to, you know, and e-commerce. we're seeing laboratory automation, getting that samples across town very quickly to a lab, you know, with the drone, so that's way faster, so it can be, the testing part can be sped up. We're seeing all of these types of things. None of them particularly seem to require a humanoid robot. And I think the most important thing to look at in robotics is that the robots that are being used are the ones that are the most economical and were useful before the pandemic. So the drones are coming out of MCC and DJI, two big major, we make platforms that anybody can use, and, you know, agricultural, they can carry this payload and you can pop in another payload. So that's one thing that we see. On the ground robots, the UVC, the disinfecting robots, have been around for years. We're being used for hospital-acquired infections. They had started out saying, oh, look, we can kill Ebola. And everybody's like, yeah, well, Ebola has gone away. It's 2016. We don't care anymore. You know, I don't want to buy a robot and keep it in a closet for an event that may never happen. Oh, hospital-acquired infections. We're getting sued. We're losing this. Our insurers won't insure us. Therefore, we must show better sanitation. Oh, these robots. Yay, robots. Okay, so you're seeing, and you look at those robots, and they're not very sophisticated because they need to be inexpensive, be able to be used beforehand. Right? So there. So humanoid robots, also, we don't have infrastructure. So humanoid robots tend to be expensive. They tend to be fussy. Who's going to be replacing the batteries? Who's going to be fixing? Oh, there, everything's unloaded off of a brain and centralized computer over here. Yeah. Who's making sure the Wi-Fi works? What happens with that? So humanoid robots aren't actually the thing that leaps up to mind first. Because what are the advantages? So I think that what I find is a lot of people are like, I have robot X, I have a humanoid robot, I have such and such robot, I have a robot with four legs, I want to help with COVID, here we go, how do you like me now? And it's like, have you ever thought about just starting like an engineer, because we're supposed to be engineers, working with the end users and saying, the demand analysis, what is it that you actually need? You just need somebody to take out the trash. That doesn't need to be a humanoid robot. And you need it cheap and reliable. You know, maybe just one of these robot carts, you know, a turtle bot. Yay, way to go. Not very exciting, but could be very useful. And so I think those are the things that we need to start looking at and remember, and not get, oh, we got cool technology. Let's go inflict it upon the responders who are already busy.
Yeah, that actually makes very much sense. Now, do you think we can improve the efficiency of these solutions, or are they already being implemented very efficiently?
There is always room for improvement. I mean, that's why we're here, right? I mean, we didn't like peak in 1967. There's always room for improvement. Right? And I think there's one of the things that we're seeing is a lot of gaps. One big gap is, hey, we're doing a lot of telepresence and we're able to take advantage of existing telepresence robots, like the double thing, you know, robots, you know, an iPad on a stick, you know, and then there's some more sophisticated ones. But what we're missing is, okay, I can roll up to you. I can look around. I can interview you. I can put a stick on me and I can kind of poke you with it, you know, to do a contact, but mostly I'm asking you to take the sensor and put it on you. I need to be able to have hands and arms that are easy to use. Now, remember, if you've done any teleoperating with arms, you know, just that the time it takes to do even a simple task is tough. So think about that. You know, what if you were, think of all the people who are starting to use the robot, telepresence robots, to visit grandma in the hospital or nursing home. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to have just something that could reach over and pull up the blanket? or just pet the hand without crushing grandma's hand. Okay, which means we need tactile and haptic sensing and control and all that. So these are this is a clear gap. But if you want to even help inventory, you know, get something, you've got to be able to grab it, fetch it, and then bring it over to the to the healthcare workers. So there's all sorts of things. Manipulation, dexterous manipulation is clear.
All right. So Dr. Murphy, could you tell us what inspired you to use science fiction to teach AI and robotics?
Yeah. Besides the fact that science fiction's fun and everywhere, the big one is that I was trying, and I actually had a fellowship as a fellow, an innovative teaching fellow, and I said, I'm going to take all of our case studies from disasters, and I'm going to create a set of case studies for teaching robotics. You know, we're going to teach, you know, things like navigation. We'll use it for planning, for AI reasoning, for this, and there just weren't enough cases, and we don't use them that way. I mean, robots aren't really as sophisticated as we can see them becoming. We're a nascent field, right? We're an emerging field. We're still learning about AI. We're still creating the AI. So we don't have robots that do that much that well. Not really. But in science fiction, they do. Science fiction, they do. They take over. You have evil robots. You have good robots. You have robots that can talk. You have robots that make little beeping noises. You've got all these things, and they become a very good, compelling discussion, ways of saying, would a robot do that? How would it do that? Is that possible? Is that desirable? So that's why I started teaching with science fiction.
That is a wonderful idea, actually. Moving on. What is your vision for the future of disaster robotics as a field?
Well, my vision of it is to a certain degree, it's that it keeps on as an intellectual discipline, but it kind of goes away because robotics for disasters are just so common that you don't think of them as a special field. I mean, because it's like they're just everywhere. I mean, when you think of a disaster, you know, thinking of Beirut, you're probably thinking of guys. You know, men and women with hard hats and yellow vests, and there's probably a dog, and they're holding some sort of chemical sniffer. And now I want to see, and there's a bomb squad robots, I mean, those robots that look like they're from the Hurt Locker, and then, you know, drones overhead, and of course, you know that if you didn't see the robots in there, it'd be like not seeing people with hard hats and vests. It's like, what are they doing? Where's the stuff they need? Yeah. So that would be my vision. Of that it becomes so normalized that it becomes routine, that it's not a big deal at all.
That is nice to hear. So a lot of people look up to you, and you are an inspiration to women in STEM. Is there anything you would like to say to them?
You know, it seems very trite, but to think about how they want to organize their life and their careers to do the things that mean the most for them. One of my friends gave a wonderful talk on robotics, and some kid asked, I want to do robotics. And he said, you know what? You don't have to be a roboticist. You don't have to have a PhD like her. You can be a machinist. Or you can be a website designer for a robotics company. You can do that. And he was listing all the ways that are all part of the enterprise of making robots useful for people. And it didn't always come down to, well, you have to do this and you have to have a lot of math, and that only certain people are smart enough. So if you find there's something you want to do, and the obvious path says, oh, well, you're not smart enough, or you don't have enough college, or you don't have enough this, is think about, wait, what are the other ways I can be involved? What can I do? Because there's always a way for you to do things to help other people in a way that takes advantage of your unique capabilities.
That was very inspirational.
So thank you so much for your time today.
We're off. Okay.
Yeah.
It was Yeah, it was very interesting and informative talking to you. Have a good day.
I hope it's useful to you all. Let me send me the link when it's up. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.